EcoReport is a weekly public affairs program
providing independent media coverage
of environmental and ecological studies
with a focus on local, state, and regional people, issues, and events
in order to foster open discussion
of human relationships with nature and the earth
and to encourage you to take personal responsibility for living sustainably in the world.
EcoReport is produced by an independent team of volunteers
working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
And financially supported by listeners like you.
Good morning and welcome to EcoReport. For WFHB, I'm Linda Leitner.
And I'm Glenn Leitner. A new Indiana law could prevent so-called water wars between Indiana and Kentucky, according to New Albany's News and Tribune. House-enrolled Act 1211 sets up the Transborder Water Resources Authority, which will assess who has rights to water resources shared among Indiana and neighboring states. The Water Resources Authority panel, established in the law, can also broker agreements between states. The Water Resources Authority will be made up of 4 members of the General Assembly, 4 from the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, and 4 individuals appointed by the governor.
The driving force behind the creation of the authority is that Clark County, Indiana, and Louisville, Kentucky share an aquifer, an underground body of permeable rock that can hold or transmit water. The aquifer in question is very abundant, and with both Clark County and Louisville having large factories and commercial centers, a lot of water is needed. State Representative Stephen Stemler wrote Act 1211 to avoid any kind of legal issue.
Between Tennessee and Mississippi, they have the exact same issue in terms of they share a water aquifer underneath their both states, so it transcends the state line. They are in a substantial lawsuit now where millions of dollars of not only who owns the water, but actually the revenue that's been derived by taking water out of it. They need to compensate each other for the water that they've used that they thought was theirs.
Stemler's law was the first in the state to address interstate below ground water. It received unanimous support when proposed. Stemler is now looking forward to the next step.
Well, the ultimate goal, now that our legislation has passed, and I've already been working with my counterparts in Frankfort, Kentucky, the legislators there, and they are supportive of this concept. So now the goal is to move forward and say, okay, look, we're asking you to jointly work in tandem with us to devise an authority, if you will, from Kentucky's standpoint, and then we work together, and out of those two entities, we would develop best practices and understandings and have a compact, an agreement, which is still yet to be designed. Obviously, you don't want to damage the aquifer by drawing down too much in a drought season. And then just really, I think, good communications, too, about what you anticipate your usage is going to be if you do have success in bringing in, say, a large automotive plant or something like that that's going to be a big water user.
Stemler said Kentucky is now aiming to have a similar law ready for their next legislative session. In other local news, the Solarize Bloomington initiative is beginning its second phase, encouraging residents to install solar panels before the end of the year. The program is a collaboration between the City of Bloomington and the Solar Indiana Renewable Energy Network, or SIREN. Bloomington is encouraging residents to go solar before the end of 2017 instead of waiting until 2018 when the state's new net metering system kicks in. Net metering is an arrangement that credits solar panel owners for excess power they produce. That excess power goes out to the grid for other homeowners to use. A member of the steering committee at SIREN, Ann Hedden, says crediting is currently done at the retail rate, but that will change.
So the retail rate for most customers in Duke service territory right now is between 10 and 12 cents per kilowatt hour, depending on how much they're using. It will continue to be the billing arrangement for Duke customers until 2047 if they're fully installed by the end of this year. If they're fully installed between January of 2018 and the end of 22, then they're eligible for net metering arrangements for 15 years. And then after that, homeowners' production will be credited at wholesale rates, which are approximately a quarter of the retail rate.
Hedden says she's hopeful that most people will be interested in going solar because of the decrease in the cost of solar panels. According to Siren, the price of panels has halved since 2012, although prices still vary by property, system size, and installation costs. The Solarize Bloomington initiative helps reduce expenses from materials, labor, and other costs involved in installing a solar system for residents. Hedden said homeowners participating in Solarize Bloomington's Phase 2 could be looking at prices of roughly $7,000 after a 30% federal tax credit for a 4-kilowatt system. One of those systems can generate about half the needed electricity for a typical home. Hedden said Phase 2 is expected to expand the program's boundaries past Monroe County to Greene, Lawrence, Morgan, Orange, and Owen counties.
The installer that's been chosen as the primary, the top bidder, has a great deal of capacity, and Siren has reserved the right to bring in other installers that we've worked with in case that primary contractor is overwhelmed, which I suppose is a possibility because there are a lot of people out there that want solar.
People interested in signing up should visit sirensolar.org. There, they can fill out an info form and sign up for a required information session. Last year, we reported on the assassination of Berta Cáceres, the Honduran indigenous environmental activist who was a leader of the grassroots group COPEN, the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras. On June 30th, Cáceres' 26-year-old daughter, Bertita Zuniga Cáceres, who is the new leader of COPEN, survived an assassination attempt along with two other members of the COPEN Leadership Committee. The three activists were driving home from a community meeting in central Honduras when three strange men carrying machetes used their pickup truck to block the road. The three COPEN members managed to pass, but the driver of the pickup followed and again tried to force her vehicle off the road and over the edge of a cliff. The three activists escaped unharmed. Since the assassination of the elder Cáceres, two of her fellow environmentalists were murdered and several others have survived assassination attempts.
2016 was the deadliest in a series of deadly years for grassroots environmentalists. It was especially dangerous for indigenous activists defending their communities, forests, and rivers from mining, timber, agribusiness, and oil companies. A record number of 200 environmentalists were assassinated last year while protesting corporate environmental destruction, according to a new report by Global Witness. Until 2016, 2015 was the deadliest year on record for environmentalists, with 185 murdered over 16 countries. The report found that almost 4 people were killed each week in 24 countries in 2016. Brazil was the most dangerous location for activists, with 49 killings last year. It was followed by Colombia, with 37 assassinations. In the Philippines, 28 people fighting the mining industry died last year because of their activism. Murders took place also in India, Honduras, Nicaragua, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The report noted that nearly 40% of those killed were indigenous and 60% were Latin American.
The Natural Resources Defense Council has issued a new report saying that over half of Hoosiers live in counties with a combination of high ragweed pollen levels and excessive ozone or smog days. In Indiana, 25 counties have reported an average of one or more unhealthy smog days each year. 65 have reported the presence of ragweed, and 17 suffer from both, which are substantial problems for people with allergies and especially for people with asthma. The report says rising temperatures fueled by the warming climate speed up ozone production. The greenhouse gas carbon dioxide helps ragweed flourish, while many hot days mean more pollen is present over a longer period of time. Nationwide, the report found that 127 million Americans, or 40% of the population, live in counties with significant ozone and ragweed. The report says not to engage in outdoor activity, if possible, on high pollen days.
Speaking of pollen, a common and much criticized pesticide dramatically weakens already vulnerable honeybee hives, according to a new massive field study in three European countries. For more than a decade, the population of honeybees and other key pollinators have been on the decline, and scientists have been trying to figure out what's behind the drop, mostly looking at a combination of factors that include disease, parasites, poor diet, and pesticides. Past studies, mostly lab-based experiments, have pointed to a problem with the insecticides called neonicotinoids, sometimes called neonics. New research done in Britain, Hungary, and Germany is the largest field study yet.
Researchers planted about 7.7 square miles of fields of rapeseed, which is made into cooking oil called canola oil in America. Some of the fields were planted with seeds treated with the insecticide. Others were planted with the untreated seeds. The researchers followed bees from the spring of 2015 when these seeds flowered through to the following spring when new bees were born. The beehives in the Hungarian and British fields with pesticide-treated seeds had a more difficult time surviving the winter, the researchers found. In Hungary, the honeybee colonies near treated fields had 24% fewer worker bees the next spring when compared to those near untreated crops, according to a study published in the journal Science. But in Germany, the bees didn't seem harmed. Hives there were generally healthier to start with, and when scientists analyzed the pollen brought back to the hives, they determined that the German bees ate a far broader diet. A much smaller percentage, just 10% of the bees' nutrition, came from the pesticide-treated rapeseed plants. In Hungary and England, this percentage reached 50%.
When hives are weakened by disease, parasites, or bad diet, as many hives are worldwide, then the neonicotinoids pushes them over the edge, said Pywell, a scientist at the Center for Ecology and Hydrology in England. Sadly, so many of the British hives died in both treated and untreated fields that scientists couldn't calculate the specific effect of the insecticide, he said. The same study also found that wild bees were weakened by the insecticide, but in different ways, Pywell said. For wild bees and honeybees, one neonicotinoid brand seemed to cause greater harm. Another study in the journal also finds problems with neonicotinoids in a study in Canada. Both the European and Canadian studies show that neonicotinoids harm bees. However, it still may not be the leading cause of bee losses, said University of Maryland entomologist Dennis Van Ingelsdorp, who wasn't part of the study. The problem remains complex, like cancer, Van Ingelsdorp said in an email.
Neonicotinoids makers Bayer and Syngenta paid for the European study but had no control over the results or the published paper. And company officials pointed to the results in Germany and the lack of harm to hives there. In an email, Bayer spokesman Jeffrey Donald wrote, quote, "The study shows that when hives are healthy and relatively disease-free and when bees have access to diverse forage, neonics do not pose a danger to colony health," unquote. And in a statement, Syngenta's Peter Campbell, head of research collaboration, said the study, quote, "strongly suggests the effects of neonics are a product of interacting factors," unquote.
Europe banned neonicotinoids in 2013, and researchers needed a special exemption to do their recent study. Neonics are not currently banned in the USA. Purdue Extension recommends treating trees and plants after they have flowered. However, issues still remain because seeds, such as soybeans, are treated before planting. And that's the news for this week. I'm Linda Leitner.
And I'm Glenn Leitner. We love to hear from our listeners. Contact us about stories we've aired or if you have ideas for future stories. Please send emails to earth@wfhb.org. We'll be right back. today's Eco Report feature, correspondent Norm Holey speaks with a local farmer about his do-it-yourself solar energy project.
For WFHB, and today I'm speaking with Russ Bailey, who is a farmer in Greene County. He has installed solar at his barn, and today he's just going to talk a little bit about it. He does not only, you know, collects the current, but he's not on the grid, so he actually does the battery. So, Russ, would you describe your system for me?
Well, we've got the 200-watt silicon solar panels out there. They're monocrystalline panels, and it comes in to the, my building here and goes through a voltage regulator that'll convert whatever voltage comes in to 13.5-14 volts, whatever it takes to charge the batteries, and also keeps me from overcharging my batteries and burning them up. So I've got probably 1,000 amps or 3,000 amps of batteries there, and then I've got a sine wave inverter to invert the 12 volts back into 110, so I can run my power tools, skill saw, fan, air compressor, whatever I need there. And it's just handy to have here in the building. I don't have to run a power cord to the barn. And
and how are you using it? I know you have a sawmill. Is that part of this?
Yes, I've got a sawmill here in the barn that I can keep my batteries maintained. I got tractors sitting here that I've got an extension cord that I can run trickle charge off from my panel and keep the batteries in the dump trailer charged up when I'm not using it, and tractors and sawmill. And
now, are the batteries anything special, or are these
kinds of
batteries that that other people could easily acquire?
No, these are just regular, these are probably like automotive batteries. We get them, I got these from a battery recycling center, and these were some that were still good, so I didn't have a lot in them as far as cost, but you know, they could go bad at any time too, so.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as they're fully charged, then there's not, they don't go bad so quick as long as you keep them full, pretty well charged.
Uh-huh. So your barn is how far from your supplied power?
It's probably 300 feet, maybe.
Uh-huh. And so what did you do before you installed this? I mean, did you run a power cord down from?
I ran extension cord down across the driveway and the ground.
That's fantastic. So, and how has it worked so far? Has it been
so far? It's
trouble-free.
It's been trouble-free, and it's supplied more power than I need. But I don't use a lot of power in here at times.
So yeah.
Sometimes it's convenient.
Yeah. So it's mostly a convenience thing.
Yes.
I think it's really pretty amazing, you know, that you figured this all out on your own and did the installation and everything?
Well, there's a lot of information on YouTube and the internet, and whether it's correct or not, but that's the information I went on.
Uh-huh. it's obviously working.
Well, it's working, yes.
You've had this how long now?
It's been probably 8 months now, 7-8 months, and I installed it, I think, in December or January, something like that. So.
Uh-huh. I think it's really admirable that you made the effort to do this kind of thing, and it really shows sort of the Hoosier independence, you know. I'm not going to depend on other people. I can take care of myself.
Well, I sort of have an electronic background from being a computer technician, and so it was not all completely strange to me.
Yeah, so. Right. So other people could install this kind of a system?
Oh, yeah. And the more that's made, you know, the cheaper the prices are on the panels. And, you know, they've come down a lot in the last few years, so.
Right, yeah. Where were the panels manufactured, do you know? Have any idea?
I think they were made in Canada, maybe. I don't know. I got them off from Amazon.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah. So you can you get all this equipment from Amazon?
Yes, I ordered all this equipment on Amazon.
I mean, other than the batteries, right?
Yes.
Very nice. It's a very nice system. So this is Norm Holy, WFHB, and I've been interviewing Russ Bailey today on his solar installation.
EcoReport is currently seeking volunteer journalists to contribute short weekly headlines about ecological issues from indigenous resistance to infrastructure projects to climate change and biological diversity. Commitment is light and you can set your own schedule. For more information, email us at earth@wfhb.org or call 812-323-1200. It's time now for In Nature, a segment focusing on the flora and fauna of South Central Indiana.
This is In Nature.
That, my friends, is the yellow-crowned night heron. It's a rare bird in Indiana. They have a white crown and back with the remainder of the body grayish, red eyes, and short yellow legs. They have a white stripe below the eye. It's a very handsome bird. It's a medium-sized heron, averaging 24 inches in length. The yellow-crowned night heron is mostly found in southern swamps and coastal areas, but a few can be found breeding northward to Indiana and Illinois. The great majority of the yellow-crowned night heron's diet consists of crustaceans, and it is a nocturnal hunter. Both sexes help build the nest, which can be as high as 60 feet or so, away from the trunk on a horizontal limb, often hanging over water. Initially, the female stands on the nest while a male carries sticks to her as part of the pair bonding process. Later, the female also gathers sticks. The nest takes about 11 days to build initially. Night herons use them for several years, adding to them each year. Nests can be as large as 4 feet across, with just a shallow depression inside for the 2 to 6 eggs.
You've been listening to In Nature, a production of WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
And now for our weekly events calendar. Take a lake stroll hike at Brown County State Park on Saturday, July 22nd from 10 to 11 a.m. Meet at the Stroll Lake parking lot for a fun and informative hike around the smaller of two lakes located in Brown County State Park. Learn about the flora and fauna that inhabit the Brown County Hills. This 1 mile loop hike is rated as moderate and will last about 1 hour, depending on what is discovered.
H2O water quality monitoring will take place on Sunday, July 23rd from 1 to 2 p.m. at the Waterfall Shelter in Lower Cascades Park in Bloomington, Indiana. The water looks clean, but is it? Learn what it takes to be a water quality scientist by discovering what makes water healthy and how to collect water quality data. Wear sturdy shoes that you can get wet. Please register at bloomington.in.gov/parks.
Learn about Indiana's most endangered tree on the Yellowwood Trail hike at Brown County State Park on Monday, July 24th from 2 to 3 p.m. Meet in the Raleigh Camp parking area at the Trail 5 trailhead at Oogle Hollow Nature Preserve. This hike will take you along Trail 5, which is a 0.7-mile hike rated rugged because of its steepness. Please bring water and proper footwear for an opportunity to view the spectacular tree.
There will be a Red Fox Roundup at the Paintown State Recreation Area at Monroe Lake on Wednesday, July 26th from 8 to 8:30 p.m. The elusive red fox can be a real challenge to track. Join the naturalist to learn about this canine carnivore, its habits and habitat at the Activity Center Amphitheater.
And finally, take a morning bird hike at Spring Mill State Park on Sunday, July 30th from 10 to 11 a.m. Learn not just the names, but the stories behind the birds we see. Every bird's place in the world is a bit different from the next. Bring binoculars or borrow a pair and meet in front of Spring Mill Inn.
That wraps up our show for this week. EcoReport is brought to you in part by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003. And on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
This week's news stories were written by Cole Stinson, Norm Holey, and Linda Green. The feature was produced by Norm Holey. Rebecca Mueller edited the script. Juliana Daly compiled our events calendar. Our engineer is Sarah Vaughn. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Linda Leitner.
And I'm Glenn Leitner. Join us on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. before Democracy Now! And on Fridays at 5 p.m. before Kiteline for our weekly radio rundown of ecological news and resistance. Until then, EcoReport encourages you to take direct action to defend the Earth.
You've been listening to the EcoReport,
a volunteer-powered production of Community Radio WFHB
in Bloomington, Indiana.
Available for download and podcast at news.wfhb.org.
EcoReport is your independent, ecologically inspired news source
for South Central Indiana.
Bringing you news that the Earth wants you to hear.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas
directly to the EcoReport staff.
The email address is
earth@wfhb.org.
That's earth@wfhb.org.